don't, because they've given Iran a lot of support. They've given it their latest EW systems, that's electronic warfare systems, to disrupt missiles. And I don't know whether they've given them other things. But, you know, there's still a prevalent view in the West that Iran is somehow sort of backward and not very tech-orientated. I mean, the radars, these over-the-horizon radars that were supposedly attacked and destroyed but were not, that Iran has, are Iranian. They've had a certain amount of Chinese help, but for 10 years they have been building some of the most sophisticated radar systems as well as missile systems. They're not backward, so it's not, you know, de haut en bas, sorry, the sort of, you know, condescension of Russia to give our friends who are a little bit backward some help. On the contrary, in many areas, Iran are ahead of Russia, and in other areas, Russia is ahead on Iran. But this is one of the tipping points that is taking place in the world. Not only are the militaries changing, you know, air power against missile power, changing the warfare of the region, but also technology increasingly is not the preserve of the West, any of us, any longer. It's as much the preserve of China and of Russia and Iran as it is in the West. And we find that very, very difficult to assimilate. And that was why it was a subject of a report that I mentioned to you by RAND organization, which said, you know, we might lose these wars if we take on the world, because we don't have the capacity any longer. And I think it was showing up a key contradiction. I think because it's very hard to explain how they could say, you know, that the West doesn't have suitable weapon system. It's not ready to fight wars. It certainly can't fight any war against any one of these people, let alone collectively. And if we tried to do that against one, it could lose. And I think it's going back to a basic, if you like, contradiction in American and European societies. You probably may have seen that the British government nearly did fall 2 years ago because bondholders just wouldn't go on financing the deficit in Britain. The same thing's happening in France. It's returned again to Britain, where the government can't finance its deficit and its borrowing requirements. Mm. And in the United States, too, you know, the cost of interest on the debt exceeds the entire defense budget. And I think possibly we're seeing some pushback against the sort of neoconservative view that, you know, oh, yes, we are the United States. We can take on China, Russia, Iran. You know, let them try. We can do that because we have the best military. We have the best. But actually, the problem is for 20 years, the West has been, you know, pursuing what is called a sort of soft fiscal posture, i.e. printing bonds, selling them to the central bank, which monetizes them, prints money to finance our expenditure. Our expenditure goes up and up, and now we are reaching the point where the interest rates, well, bondholders have to decide, you know, what are they going to do? Are they going to decline to pay on their bonds? Are they going to default on their bonds? Or are they going to cut expenditures and meet the dangers? There's a historian that is the favorite of hedge funds in Wall Street who's just said, you know, have you noticed actually we, the West, I mean France, Britain, the United States, you know, we've become the Soviet Union. I mean, the same problems, the despair, the sort of the sense of divisions within the Soviet Union before the reform. And he said, and, you know, the main thing was that, you know, it was a very relaxed fiscal environment. So companies became less efficient, less capable. They just dragged on because the government would always bail them out with more money. until it all collapsed. And I'm just saying, I think perhaps some people in the Pentagon are saying to the neocons, you know, you talk, you know, about as if the American hegemony, as if it's the 60s and 70s, you know, that when, you know, all of Europe was in disarray, was broken by the war, and you were 50% of global economy, and now you're only 15%. You know, neocons, wake up. We have to have a different policy because we are failing in every area of our defense capability. This is, and RAND, for those that don't know it, is, par exemple, the NGO of the Pentagon. It's funded by the Pentagon. It reflects, always has reflected funding.
So what's going on? The NGO, non-governmental organization funded by the Pentagon, fabulously rich and filled with vast resources, predicts that the United States is unprepared for war. The United States military budget is $886 billion a year. The United States interest on its debt is now $1 trillion a year. Everything you're saying is backed up by the hard facts. I want to show you a full screen. It's from the New York Post, which is owned by the same people that I used to work for that run Fox News and the Wall Street Journal. Iran claims it can build nukes, threatens Israel and U.S. with, quote, tooth-breaking retaliation. That's from Saturday's New York Post.
I think this is what Iran is now about, it's the end of strategic patience, and they are ready to see a strategic shift in the Middle East because Israel was unable to attack their defenses or to get through. I think the bigger picture, the one that is unsaid, is if Israel is unable to penetrate into secured Iranian airspace, is America capable of doing that for all their threats? And they're saying, well, you know, we'll join in. We've sent B-52s. Oh, yeah? Well, do we know that, you know, their stealth fighters will not be met by stealth, anti-stealth defenses in Iran? That seems to have been, and it's only speculation, but it seems to have been quite possible from what we saw before. So the whole strategic position, which is, oh, well, Israel can go. You know, Iran is not Lebanon, where they're just massacring the citizens to sort of blackmail them into pushing for a ceasefire. You can do that in Lebanon and in other countries than they have. But Iran has said, I'm sorry, but, you know, we have the strategic edge and you don't, and America doesn't have. And this is what RAND report was saying, the RAND organization was saying, we don't have actually even the strategic edge anymore. America doesn't have strategic edge. Well, who does? Well, we only have to look to Ukraine and we only have to look to Iran to see that perhaps some of this, you know, it's slowly, you know, the hegemony is slipping and slipping, and it's visible that it's slipping. It's not down to zero. But that the RAND report is saying, you know, we have to really think very carefully about where we're going. Of course, the RAND suggests that really the answer is, you know, to spend more and more and more, 16, 17% of GDP on defense, and to have an all of government to go on to a complete war footing, I mean, active war footing, in order to fight a sort of a possible global war. And they say, you know, isn't it obvious, you know, we are now having to face the idea that the United States is at war globally with the global world. I mean, you know, this is a quite a dramatic statement coming out of, you know, the Pentagon's favorite research organization.
Alistair, thank you very much, my dear friend. Startling information about American weakness and Israeli deception, but none of it should surprise us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge.
Of course.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Speaking at the COP29 United Nations Climate Summit in Baku, the Republic of Azerbaijan, the U.S. climate envoy John Podesta claimed the fight for a cleaner, safer planet will not stop under a re-elected Donald Trump, even if some progress is reversed. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Donald Trump has picked Lee Zeldin, a former New York congressman, to lead the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, vowing the appointment will ensure fair and swift deregulatory decisions by the regulator. Trump, who oversaw the rollback of more than 100 environmental rules when he last was U.S. president, said that Lee Zeldin was a true fighter for America First policies and that he will ensure fair and swift deregulatory decisions that will be enacted in a way to unleash the power of American businesses, while at the same time maintaining the highest environmental standards, including the cleanest air and water on the planet. Zeldin, a Republican who was in the House of Representatives until last year as a member of a New York district that covers part of Long Island, said the nomination was an honor and that he was looking forward to cutting red tape as the Environmental Protection Agency's administrator. Zeldin wrote on X, "We will restore U.S. energy dominance, revitalize our auto industry to bring back American jobs and make the U.S. a global leader of AI." He added, "We will do so whilst protecting access to clean air and water." Lee Zeldin, a 44-year-old, is considered a close Donald Trump ally. He ran in a surprisingly close race for New York governor in 2022, before being pipped by Kathy Hochul, a Democrat. During the campaign, Zeldin attacked Hochul's far-left climate agenda and assailed Democrats for allegedly forcing people to drive electric cars. The Environmental Protection Agency nominee, who will have to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate, has rarely spoken out on environmental or climate issues, although he said back in 2014 he was not sold yet on the whole argument that we have a serious problem, as other people are, with global warming, and added in 2018 that he did not support the Paris Climate Accord, which Donald Trump is expected to withdraw from. Zeldin, who has a score of just 14% from the League of Conservation Voters on his votes on environmental issues in his 15 years in Congress, is expected to oversee an overhaul of the Environmental Protection Agency that will rival anything seen since its foundation in 1970. An exodus of staff is expected from the agency, with employees already raising fears they will be subject to political interference and that their work to protect Americans from toxic chemicals and planet-heating emissions from cars, trucks and power plants will be torn up. Ben Jealous, executive director of the Sierra Club, said Zeldin's nomination, naming an unqualified anti-American worker who opposes efforts to safeguard our clean air and water, lays bare Donald Trump's intentions to once again sell our health, our communities, our jobs and our future out to corporate polluters. Ben Jealous added, "Our lives, our livelihoods and our collective future cannot afford Lee Zeldin or anyone who seeks to carry out a mission antithetical to the EPA's mission." The naming of Lee Zeldin less than a week after Donald Trump won the presidential election is far quicker than his previous term in the White House, when he took until December to name Scott Pruitt as his pick for the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. Pruitt resigned in 2018 amid a flurry of ethics scandals, including allegations that he gave staffers improper pay rises. The national broadcaster CBS News has also covered the same story. Speaking at the COP29 United Nations Climate Summit in Baku, the Republic of Azerbaijan, America's climate envoy John Podesta claimed the fight for a cleaner, safer planet will not stop under a re-elected Donald Trump, even if some progress is reversed. John Podesta, who is leading the Biden administration's delegation at the annual talk, said, "Although under Donald Trump's leadership, the U.S. federal government placed climate-related actions on the back burner, efforts to prevent climate change remain a commitment in the United States and will confidently continue." Trump has pledged to deregulate the energy sector, allow the oil and gas industry to drill, baby, drill, and pull the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord, which committed countries to taking steps to avoid the worst impacts of the crisis. John Podesta said, "While Trump will try to reverse progress, this is not the end of our fight for a cleaner, safer planet." The recent re-election of Trump to the White House, which will see him inaugurated for a second term in January, has cast a shadow on the United Nations talks after a Republican defeated Kamala Harris. Harris had been expected to continue the climate policies of Joe Biden, who passed the Inflation Reduction Act, the largest down payment on the green transition seen in U.S. history. Experts say Trump's second term could be even more destructive, as he will be aided by an amenably conservative judiciary and armed with detailed policy blueprints such as the Project 2025 document published by the right-wing Heritage Foundation. Donald Trump's incoming administration is already reportedly drawing up executive orders to erase climate policies and open up protected land for ramped-up oil and gas production. President-elect Trump said on Wednesday, 6th of November, "We have more liquid gold than any country in the world." Staff at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, which was targeted the last time Trump was president, are already bracing for a mass exodus. Much of the work done by the EPA staff under Biden, such as pollution rules for cars and power plants, as well as efforts to protect vulnerable communities living near industrial activity, are set to be reversed. A June analysis warned that Trump's forthcoming rollbacks could add 4 billion additional metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions to the atmosphere by 2030, when compared with the continuation of Joe Biden's policies. Jamie Minden, the 21-year-old acting executive director of Zero Hour, the U.S.-based youth-led climate non-profit organization, at a press conference about the election results in Baku, Republic of Azerbaijan on Monday, said, "That would be a death sentence for our planet." Todd Stern, who was the U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change and the United States' chief negotiator at the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, said, "Trump's looming presidency could also place a damper and other countries' climate action plans. Todd Stern said the two biggest players in the ring are the United States and China, and China is extremely aware of that. It has just got a guarantee that the US president won't be bringing up climate change with them for the next 4 years, and that means something. It will make things easier on China, and that can't help but have some impact. Todd Stern added, "Yet the fight is bigger than one election, one political cycle in one country. The UN climate conference in Baku represents a critical opportunity to cement our progress." At the COP29 summit in Baku, activists are pushing the Biden administration to file a bold climate plan under the Paris Climate Agreement, known as a nationally determined contribution, and to make big pledges to support global climate finance efforts. Ali Rosenbluth, co-manager of the climate non-governmental organization Oil Change International, said, "And President Biden still has critical opportunities to cement his climate legacy on the domestic level as well, including by rejecting pending permits for fossil fuel projects."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The International Monetary Fund is under fire for humiliating African countries seeking loans from this US-based institution. So what can African leaders do to avoid those embarrassing trips to Washington? Many natural landmarks in Africa still have colonial names, and now there are increasing calls for change. So why has it taken long for African countries to dump European names imposed on the continent? To discuss the humiliation of African countries at the International Monetary Fund, we have contacted Irene Asua. She is a Kenyan-based social scientist and human rights activist. And for more on the growing calls to eradicate colonial names in Africa, we are joined by Dr. Alexander Rochero. Now, he is the convener of the State of Africa Lecture Series at the Institute of Pan-African Narratives in Zimbabwe. The International Monetary Fund has been making headlines for the wrong reasons in Africa. This institution, based in Washington, D.C., offers loans to struggling African nations under harsh conditions, which particularly impact the poor. Between 2020 and 2022, the IMF provided more than $50 billion to sub-Saharan African countries, making the continent a major borrower at the institution. However, it is not a walk in the park for African countries to obtain IMF loans. Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for the National Treasury and Economic Planning, John Mbadi, has revealed how African countries are humiliated at the IMF headquarters. He cited his recent trip to Washington, D.C., where he and other African ministers were forced to line up in a corridor to request IMF loans. Now, this incident came months after Kenyans protested against a finance bill imposed by the IMF at the end of June 2024. Demonstrators said IMF and World Bank loans are modern-day slavery. Amid the gloom, there is hope on the horizon. The BRICS group is set to create an alternative to the exploitative International Monetary Fund. So will African countries seize this opportunity?
IMF humiliates Africans. High-level delegations from Africa traveled to Washington, D.C. last October to attend the 2024 International Monetary Fund and World Bank annual meetings. Other African countries also attended the meetings. Critics say these meetings are not based on mutual respect and that African delegations are regularly embarrassed.
Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for the National Treasury and Economic Planning, John Mbadi, recounted the condescending attitude by IMF and World Bank officials.
The first one, Chairman, you're right that I was embarrassed at Washington. Not that we were treated badly, Your Excellency. I wanted just to clarify. But you see, when you find African countries queuing in corridor, then you are called one by one. Nigeria, you come, 15, 30 minutes. Rwanda, Kenya, I mean, for those of us who have some pride, it's a bit demeaning. And you see the money that we are asking for out there, Your Excellency, if we just tighten our system, we can do without some of these monies.
The sight of African finance ministers lined up, resembling students waiting for their turn to see the principal, is quite disturbing. Now, this is the harsh reality faced by the recently appointed Kenyan Cabinet Secretary for the National Treasury. Now, what's your take on this statement by the Kenyan minister regarding a humiliation of top African officials visiting the Bretton Woods institutions in Washington, D.C.?
First, I think that statement was very ahistorical, given the nature of the Bretton Woods institutions and why they were set up in the first place. It was also very interesting for an African minister to say they were embarrassed and humiliated when that is what those institutions have indeed been doing to the African continent and for the Africans for the longest time. These were institutions that were set up when the African continent was still under the first phase of colonialism and slavery. And even after that first phase with the nominal or the flag or paper independence that we got, Africa still inherited debt despite being under slavery and colonialism. So decades later, after getting nominal independence, meaning we didn't really get the economic independence from these institutions, it is a historical and ironical to say that you are humiliated by institutions that were in fact designed to humiliate Africans.
In trying to mitigate the humiliation at the IMF, the Kenyan Cabinet Secretary for the National Treasury and Economic Planning proposed an increase in taxation. He stated that if the country tightens tax collections, it can deal without some of these loans. However, experts argue that increasing taxes on the already overburdened taxpayers will not solve Kenya's budget deficit.
Taxation of people who are already being pushed into the periphery economically or people who are already being pushed into poverty has never resolved the debt crisis. And so that's not going to work. It hasn't worked before, and it's not, I don't know, in the future, I am not sure if it's going to work. Kenya in the past decade has pushed more people into the poverty bracket. In the past regime, we had poverty double in the country. In this regime, I'm not sure, but with the economic situation and the increase of taxes and the increase of prices of basic utilities that people need, I can bet that more and more people have been pushed into poverty. And so people are not in a position to continue squeezing themselves, being that they're already in poverty. The alternative to not taking loans is ensuring that resources that are on the continent are used on the continent and that we are able to prevent the loot and the plunder and the loads of resources and money that Africa loses through minerals, through taxes that corporations and individuals that pay for immunity and come here for tax holidays don't pay, through the dismantling of the global financial architecture.
Last June, a significant protest erupted in Kenya, where outraged youth demonstrators stormed the Kenyan parliament. This protest was a direct reaction to the Finance Bill 2024, which had been approved by the Kenyan parliament despite widespread opposition. The bill, heavily influenced by the IMF reform package, included controversial taxation proposals.
The IMF claims to assist African countries, but in fact its policies hurt the poorest in the continent. Now, is impoverishing Africans the hidden agenda of the IMF?
Yes, it is deliberate, because that's why the IMF was set up in the first place, to keep countries that they were looting and plundering and indebted, and so that we don't have the right to develop. And first of all, the IMF does not have any authority or moral obligation in any manner to dictate how Africa organizes its economy. And it is such a shame that African leaders are mostly puppets of these institutions.
The World Bank and IMF are now seen by many as part of the problem facing African economies. Russia, which chairs the BRICS group this year, has called on its partners to create an alternative to the International Monetary Fund. Africa is now looking for viable and non-colonial alternatives to the predatory Bretton Woods institutions.
Africa is able to dictate its own terms, in terms of trade, in terms of exchange of anything, and in any arena, really, globally. And the other alternative that I see is a kind of a South-South cooperation, because the North-South relationship over the years has been very predatory and very unequal and very imbalanced, with one person calling the shots and then the rest of the two-thirds of the world's population follows. So for me, a viable alternative is a unification of Africa with a strengthened South-South relationship. And of course, now exploring other international ties, but with very clear terms, with clear balance and checks, and not the imbalance and the inequality that we have seen over the years within the so-called North and South.
African countries such as Egypt, Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Kenya, and Angola account for over 40% of the IMF's loan volume to Africa. Now, these countries are rich in natural resources, yet they have to run to the IMF for loans to run their economies. Analysts say a new paradigm is needed in Africa, in which African countries focus on creating wealth via adding value to minerals. Now, will this solve Africa's debt problem?
Yes, it will. Like I said, Africa has abundant, like more than enough resources for the current population and even for the future generations, and also even to support other economically deprived people out of the continent that might also be in need of such resources to propel. And so a new paradigm that Africa has a right to development, where we dictate and we have our own trajectory of development, and not necessarily following the colonial trajectory of development as we are doing now. So where we have sovereignty over our natural resources, and we have equipped and upskilled the people on the continent to be able to fuel and propel that development that is needed. For me, it's a very big possibility, and it is something that I can visualize, an Africa that has sovereignty over its natural resources.
Well, African leaders do not need to go to Washington with a begging bowl if countries in the continent have sovereignty of their natural resources. I would like to thank guest Irene Asua, a social scientist and human rights activist, for her incisive analysis. And we now take a short break before our next topic on shedding colonial names in Africa.
shedding colonial names in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Over the last few years, we have seen an awakening sweeping across Africa where people are calling on their governments to rename landmarks that are a sad reminder of the painful colonial era. Imposing alien names on geographical features by colonialists was one of the ways used to enforce European identity on African heritage. Natural wonders such as Lake Victoria in East Africa and the Victoria Falls in Zimbabwe were named after the British monarch. African officials and academics are now calling for the removal of remaining signs of oppression and believe that oppressed masses in the continent deserve healing through reclaiming their landmarks. There is increasing political goodwill for action. In Zimbabwe, the ruling ZANU-PF party says European names in the country should be changed because they aggrandize colonialism. So why are colonial names still in use across Africa decades after independence?
Africa is a post-colonial continent grappling with shedding colonial identities. The decolonization of Africa's geographical sites can be part of forming a global order without imperialism.
Renowned Kenyan professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o speaks here on how colonialists erased the identity of the colonized by renaming the places they conquered.
The colonial process does, or any process of domination, is first of all, the erasure or the memory of the subjugated, right? You literally erase the memory of who they are, their memories of the past, the memory of their being, you know, as a people. So by, after erasing that memory, you plant another memory. You can see this when people have colonized another territory. You know, the first thing you do is change, actually, the name of the territory they have conquered.
Well, it's quite baffling that Victoria Falls in Zimbabwe, one of the wonders of the world, still has a colonial name instead of the local indigenous name, Mosiatunia, meaning the smoke that thunders. Now, why has it taken this long to shed the image of colonialism and change the name of these massive waterfalls?
It's all about colonial logics. As much as we claim to be independent as African states in general and Global South in particular, there are people who really think the whole planetary Earth belongs to them and to them alone. And that any other species also belong to them, including the natural features and inhabitants of those places. So we have been thingified. We are viewed as commodity. So the colonial logic will tell you that a certain dead white man visited Africa, visited Zimbabwe, and discovered majestic Mosiatunia Falls. Yet these falls have been with the people for as long as the earth existed. So how do you characterize a situation where I go to Britain and say I have discovered this bridge, I have discovered this mountain? So it's hilarious to say the least, but the whole idea is that this is a colonial logic.
to conquer the continent, the colonialists weaponized the ethnicities of the continent. For instance, in Zimbabwe, the naming of the provinces was part of the colonialist divide-and-rule tactics. Analysts say it is critical to shed this colonial legacy in Zimbabwe and indeed across Africa.
I think this is critical because remember the states that we call ours, the sovereignty that we claim we have in Africa, is sovereignty whose umbilical cord is still attached to the illegal Berlin Colonial Conference of 1884 to 1885. So on top of that, we can then not rely on the artificiality that have been imposed through these colonial logics. That is the issue of the tribe. That is the issue of the provincialization of states that took place. You cannot have 44 years after independence, you have a certain place you call Matabeleland or Manicaland or Mashonaland. So these are sustained divide and rule tactics, as you rightly point out. But more importantly, these are future seeds of fissures that these colonialists deliberately sowed amongst the Africans. Because whenever there is a conflict, eventually the conflict will take a regional face, will take a tribal face, will take an ethnicity place, which for most of the time, these issues are very artificial as they are colonially imposed. So as much as we cannot reverse the illegally imposed colonial borders amongst and between Africans, there are certain things that we can surely reverse with political will, and issues of provincialism is one of them. You cannot build a nation when collectively that kind of a nation still has got provinces identified by artificial ethnicities. Because the people have spread all over the country and they have a right to belong to whatever province they so desire.
On this matter of renaming African landmarks, Professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o, a world-renowned Kenyan writer, has been vocal. In his book, Decolonizing the Mind, he says European colonialism fragmented the region. In his keynote speech during a public dialogue lecture at the University of Fort Hare, East London campus in South Africa, he is quoted to having said, "You need to do something about the name of this city and its streets. You need to take all those names, put them in an envelope, and write, return to sender." Now, what's your view on this statement?
Ngugi wa Thiong'o's a phenomenal text, Decolonizing the Mind. It's actually a summary of the discussion that we are having right now, where for most of the time, colonization did not only take place physically. The physical colonization that denotes to the issues of physical occupation of the global empire, the human epic movement of the Europeans, the whites, coming to forcefully seize Africa's territories, occurred simultaneously with what we call the cognitive colonization, where our mental faculties were also colonized, where our reasoning, our imaginations, our epistemologies, knowledge systems, our languages, lingual, they were all victims of the same process. So there is no way we can progress if our minds are still colonized.
Coinciding with anti-racist protests that swept the world in 2020, calls increased in Africa to rename Lake Victoria, which lies in Tanzania, Uganda, and Kenya. Known as Africa's Pride, the lake was named after Queen Victoria by British explorer in the 1850s. PLO Otieno Lumumba, a renowned Kenyan scholar, said these landmarks continue to have colonial names because African countries have not been sufficiently angry at racism and colonization.
I concur to the fact that you cannot have post-independence identity that identifies us with the very same vices that have subjugated us under rape, under forced labor, under robbery, under banditry, and most importantly, under the most extreme forms of humiliation. So there is no way you can walk in Europe and find a Chaminuka monument. You will never find a Mbuya Nehanda monument. I'm using examples of my own country, Zimbabwe. So it's very ironical because we have ceased to be colonial subjects and we have ceased to be colonial objects. So the only way Africa can be autonomous in as much as claiming its a full expression of our independence and decolonization is also to decolonize the names, is also to do away with those colonial attachments, colonial identities, because colonial identities are a way of colonizing memory and reminding future generations that there is no way you can claim your identity if that kind of identity is not associated with the erstwhile.
Several countries in Africa changed their names after political independence because they were Slavs that demean their culture and deny their accomplishments as civilizations. As recently as 2018, Africa's last sovereign monarchy, then known as Swaziland, commemorated the golden jubilee of its country's decolonization from Imperial Britain by changing its name to the present-day Kingdom of Eswatini. Now, what is the importance of such decisions to the people of Africa?
Yeah, as I have already alluded to earlier, issues of naming, they are very much attached to issues of memory. And there is no civilization that can take place outside memory. So memory is the precursor of any given form of civilization. So you will never find a Japanese brand with a European name. You will always find your Daihatsu, you will find your Hyundai, etc., your Toyota, etc. It will never happen that an American invention will have a Botswana name, a Zimbabwe name. So that is only naturally expected to take place with regards to Africa, including even the names of our states and the names of our kingdoms. We can't have a state called South Africa. That's hilarious, to say the least, because South Africa has got a non-name, that is Azania. So when you have Swaziland saying, no, originally we were Eswatini, yes, they are rightful to say that.
Well, indeed, the movement for total decolonization of Africa is unstoppable. I would like to thank Dr. Alexander Rusero from Zimbabwe for his insight today. And that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. From me, Wobara, Kenya, and the entire crew, it's goodbye for now.
Drown in my dreams, you'd be wide awake in the night, fighting the extremes. One day I opened my eyes and met the morning breeze. It was carrying your scent through streets and alleys. Ever since you left, I must confess, the world has become a total mess. You were the bridge that connected hearts, always there for us when we were in distress. Everywhere I look, I see your trace. You tried to make the world a better place. Oppressors will never forget your frown. The oppressed will not forget the smile on your face. Oh, how you shine like a constellation in the sky. Oh, how you shine in the minds of nations that hold you high. Oh, tell me how it feels under the tree of bliss. The trees you planted are missing you, but they've learned to blossom just like you. Though you were martyred mercilessly, an army of you is growing globally. 'Cause people are tired of all this prejudice. They wanna fight like you against injustice. Your name is Qasem Soleimani. You're a hero of humanity.
You defy the limits of intelligence, sending shivers down the spine of global arrogance. You decried oppression in every form, even though it put you in the eye of the storm. You extinguish the flames of terror far and wide. You help countries to reclaim their land that was occupied. That's why people will remember you as a hero. Though the powers that be will picture you as a foe. You see, they instigate the terror and manipulate the news so they can whitewash every crime to make the world confused. They can say what they want, let them curse at the mirror. Truth will always prevail, let them live in error.
You found the key to heaven's gate. Martyred for justice, what a noble fate. Your legacy will linger on. Forever your name we celebrate. Oh, how you shine like a constellation in the sky. Oh, how you shine in the minds of nations that hold you high. The tree of bliss. Oh, how you shine like a constellation in the sky. Oh, how you shine in the minds of nations that hold you high. Oh, tell me how it feels under the tree of bliss. Oh, how you
Limelight. After a year of committing genocide in the Gaza Strip, an increasing number of Israeli soldiers are silently refusing orders to return to the battlefield, citing psychological exhaustion and demoralization. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has covered this story and tells us more. An increasing number of Israeli soldiers are silently refusing orders to return to the battlefield in the besieged Gaza Strip, due in large part to the resistance put up by the Palestinian fighters. According to a recent report in the Israeli news outlet Hamakom, interviews with over 20 parents and soldiers in a range of battalions have revealed growing dissatisfaction within the ranks. Hamakom said, after 12 consecutive months of a war that goes nowhere, the soldiers are black. In military slang, this means that they're depressed, worn out, and unmotivated. The Israeli soldiers say they are now depressed, unmotivated, worn out, and psychologically damaged due to an unending campaign of death and destruction across the region. Parents say their sons are demoralized, having to return to places in Gaza where they fought months ago. A parent named Aidit said the return to the places such as Jabalia, Al-Zaytun and Shujaiya broke the soldiers, adding, "These are the same places where they lost their friends. The area was already clean. It had to be preserved. It frustrated them a lot." The parents, Aidit, said, "What kills them is the conditions and the duration of the fighting with no end in sight. You never know when you will get out, and it's been like this for over a year." Among the Nahal Brigade, soldiers spent 5 weeks fighting in Gaza before returning home to rest, something they have done 11 times so far since October of last year. However, according to the report, during the 11th deployment, only 6 soldiers of a platoon of 30 showed up. The others came up with an excuse. Inbal, mother of one of the soldiers in the platoon, said, "I call it refusal and rebellion." She said, "They returned to the same buildings that they cleaned, each time trapping them anew. They have been to Al-Zaytun neighborhood 3 times already. They understand that it is futile and pointless," adding, "Because they were a small team, they couldn't go out on missions. They just stayed there and waited for the time to pass. It was even more unnecessary." Another parent of an Israeli soldier in Nahal platoon said, "The wards are empty. Everyone who is not dead or injured is mentally damaged. There are very few left who return to fight, and they're not quite right either." The mother of an Israeli commando recounted her son's frustration. She said, "We're like sitting ducks at the range. We don't understand what we're doing here. The captives don't come back a second and third time. And you see, it's endless, and soldiers get injured and die on the way." In March, 4 soldiers of the unit were killed, and dozens more were injured in 3 different attacks. After returning from Gaza, the unit was converted to a reserve and sent right back to fight in Gaza. Israeli soldiers have been demolishing residential buildings with explosives, sniping children, shelling hospitals and schools housing the displaced, and destroying Gaza's water and electrical infrastructure. After Israel's ground offensive into Lebanon, in which the regime suffered major setbacks, losing a considerable number of its troops, a mother said her son told her, "I don't know what army they're thinking of entering Lebanon with, but I'm not going back to the battalion." Another Israeli soldier said offensives were being done halfway due to the lack of manpower, adding, "The platoons are empty. Those who aren't dead or physically wounded are mentally broken. Very few come back to fight, and even they aren't fully okay." Among mothers of soldiers, the phenomenon is called silent refusal or grey refusal. The Israeli military has published the names of over 750 of its troops killed since October of 2023, including more than 350 who were killed on the ground in Gaza. About 50 troops have been killed and hundreds more injured in attacks along Lebanon's border in recent weeks. The resistance front says the number of military fatalities the Israeli regime has suffered is much higher, as it keeps the real figures under the lid. The website of Al Mayadeen television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Israeli military has reportedly warned several troopers that they will be prosecuted if they do not return to the Gaza Strip amid growing cases of such refusals in recent months. According to Israel's Kan public broadcaster, at least 20 Israeli soldiers from an infantry brigade have refused to return to the war in Gaza, where Palestinian fighters have put up a spirited defense against the invaders since October of last year. The report added around 10 of the Israeli soldiers have received official warnings that they would face trial for disobeying military orders. Some of the Israeli forces say they're unable to return to Gaza following months of combat, but nonetheless, they're ready to assume other duties. Families of the soldiers say that their relatives